You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 6th of May 2014 on Monocle 24.
Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One. I'm Andrew Tuck. Coming up on today's programme. A grim message from the head of Boko Haram, the Nigerian rebel group, which claims to be holding over 200 schoolgirls kidnapped last month hostage. We'll ask whether the government in Abuja is doing enough to secure their release. I'll be joined by Kathleen Burke of University College London and George Brock of City University to discuss that and many more of the day's key news events. Also ahead, we'll be in Paris to ask whether renewed economic pressure is forcing President François Hollande into a corner.
2 years ago, François Hollande came to office with all sorts of promises and a fairly dark period in France's economic history 2 years ago, and people were hoping that he would be able to turn things around.
And before the end of the programme? Oh yes, we'll bring you a preview of tonight's first semi-final at this year's Eurovision Song Contest in Copenhagen.
Most importantly, the bookies' favourite is performing tonight, Aaron MP3 from Armenia. His song, Not Alone, is hotly tipped to win the contest this year. You'll be a first for Armenia.
All that and much, much more to come right here on Midori House with me, Andrew Tuck. So, lots coming up here in the next hour on Midori House, but before any of that, here's James Luckhurst with the latest news.
Monocle 24 News. Reports from Nigeria say suspected Boko Haram militants have kidnapped 8 more girls in the northeast of the country. The latest kidnapping happened on Sunday night in the village of Warabe in Borno State. The girls taken were between the ages of 12 and 15. On Monday, Boko Haram's leader threatened to sell more than 230 girls seized from their school, also in Borno in April. Russia's Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov has ruled out holding fresh talks in Geneva to defuse the Ukraine crisis unless pro-Russian opposition groups are involved. Mr. Lavrov added there was no point, as an April accord between the US, EU and Russia had not been implemented. A spokesman for the UN Commissioner for Human Rights, Rupert Colville, said the organisation remained very concerned about the developing situation.
The High Commissioner is basically calling both on the government, on the military and the police to make sure they keep the moral high ground, they stay within accepted international standards of how they operate. And of course the armed groups are really a major, major problem, and they need to disarm, put down their weapons, free people they've been detaining illegally, and basically the whole situation needs to cool down.
Ministers from the group of 7 industrial nations have declared they're extremely concerned about the energy security implications of developments in Ukraine. The ministers, meeting in Rome, promised to improve energy efficiency and to invest in strengthening the existing supply network infrastructure. Speaking at the closing news conference, the US Energy Secretary Ernest Moniz said everyone would prefer a political solution, but that may not be possible.
The fact is, the situation is not obviously improving at the moment, and I think a very key issue will be if the situation continues to escalate, for the G7 leaders to move forward as they have agreed in terms of elevating the sanctions, particularly at some point moving towards sectoral sanctions.
Thailand's Prime Minister has appeared before the Constitutional Court in Bangkok to defend herself against allegations of abuse of power. The complaint was filed by senators who said Mrs. Yingluck Shinawatra's party benefited from improperly transferring her national security chief in 2011. Mrs. Yingluck could be removed from office and banned from politics for 5 years if found guilty. British politicians today summoned bosses of the US drug maker Pfizer to explain a $106 billion takeover bid for pharmaceutical firm AstraZeneca. The bid has raised fears over UK jobs, research and intellectual property. Prime Minister David Cameron is facing growing pressure from Parliament to secure undertakings from the New York-based company if it pulls off Britain's biggest takeover by a foreign buyer. And the US Defense Secretary Chuck Hagel says the American military will have to become used to doing more with less in years to come. Speaking at a meeting of the Chicago Council on Global Affairs, he warned of increased global challenges and reduced budgets and spoke of an historic transition.
A transition from protracted wars in the Middle East and Central Asia to new challenges, threats, and opportunities. And from seemingly limitless resources to constrained budgets. What hangs in the balance is not just America's military, but also America's global standing. Our global standing for years to come.
And those are the top stories here at Monocle 24.
Thank you very much, James. You're listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24, and we're right back after this.
London, New York, Tokyo. This is Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo. Това е Monocle 24.
Londres, Nova York, Tokyo.
London, New York, Tokyo. Dette er Monocle 24.
Londonist, New Yorkist, Tokyost. See on Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo. Monocle 24 desu.
Londino, New York, Tokyo.
This is Monocle 24.
And you're listening to Midori House, where the time here in London now is 18.06, which means it's 13.06 in New York. And joining me now with their take on the news here in the studio is Kathleen Burke, Professor of Modern and Contemporary History at University College London, and George Brock, Head of Journalism at London's City University. Welcome both to the programme. Now, on Monday, the head of the Nigerian rebel group Boko Haram released a video claiming responsibility for the kidnap of hundreds of schoolgirls on the 14th of April. In the message, he claimed that they were prepared to sell the children on. This latest grim chapter in the story of the girls' disappearance has cast fresh focus on President Goodluck Jonathan and his authority in the country. Kathleen, when we look at what's happening in Abuja, does it mean that really the government has little writ over this part of the country and that's why they seem so ineffective?
Well, does the government really want to have much writ over that part of the country? It's poor. There's very little happening there in terms of way of making your living. It's a long way from the center. And although the Nigerian army is closing in around the area, the area itself is not under their control. You're quite right. It's a very difficult situation because even if they pretended they cared, which they don't seem up to doing very well, there's not a lot yet they can do without going in and killing a lot of people.
George, your reading of the situation.
I think I'd add to what Kathleen has said that the province where this is at its worst, right up in the northeast corner of Nigeria, is very close to the border of both Chad and Cameroon, I think, and therefore quite a lot of the kidnapped girls have probably been moved across the border out of Nigeria altogether, thus making the situation even worse. But we have read also that there are terrible arguments between the different parts of the security forces in Nigeria, and although it's a big state, it is in many ways a very weak state, and it can't do all the thing that it's doing. That hasn't been an enormous problem until what you get is the violent insurgency that you get now. And by degrees, that insurgency has got worse and more dangerous and more vicious. So I don't think the situation looks very good. And I have to say, I think the prospects of recovering people who they have abducted, certainly in their entirety, don't look very good either.
Kathleen, obviously there's a sectarian story unfolding here as well, you know, Christian versus Muslim. And it looks for many of the Christian communities in that part of the country increasingly precarious. It also for Muslim people who are putting their kids through any kind of education. There's, you know, we have some sense of, you know, what was happening with, you know, the Taliban in Afghanistan, this idea that women should not get any kind of education at all. Do you think that this begins to mean the end of civil society in that part of the country? Because if people retreat from allowing their kids to go to school, if they are forced to kind of, you know, be wary even of them leaving their home, then you begin to see kind of people pulling away, maybe Christians moving to the south and things. Do you think it's that fundamental, the threat to, you know, Nigeria, a country which on many levels seems prosperous and successful?
Yes, it's certainly prosperous since they reconfigured the basis of how they were counting GDP and so forth. But yes, it's the major economy right now in Africa and very important. The problem is in that area, only 5% of the kids went to school anyhow. So not so, but yes, it's made it incredibly dangerous to go along. So if you're not committed full-heartedly to educating, especially your daughter, you're unlikely to let them go. Yes, it's a problem with sectarian. Apparently, these poor girls, when they were sold into marriage, as it were, because God told them to do so, they made the Christian girls convert to Islam to make sure it was all nice and tidy. Civil society, well, you know, it's how one defines it. If it was a place where people worked together, lived together, married each other, and weren't getting killed a lot, yes, they had it. And now, no, they don't.
George, obviously we've seen the Americans and the British and many others offering some kind of help if they can. But is this a situation where kind of, you know, military intelligence or spotter planes or anything is really going to come in handy?
Well, obviously in the short run, it's just conceivable that that kind of assistance might make some difference to recovering somebody. But the grim aspect of this situation is, if you think back to Afghanistan, where there was also a problem about people in education, and particularly girls in education, and the views of some Muslims about that, what do you do if you have a divided subject over whether or not girls should go to school or not? You can't send a soldier to school with every girl throughout their school career. That's just not feasible. So I think it is possible to see, and people have predicted this obviously for a long time, that in the end, you may find that Nigerian society divides, but in the end, that's not likely to be, really, certainly not to the material advantage of the northern, very broadly speaking, Muslim half of the country, which is very much, as Kathleen was saying, the poorer half of the country as well. But you can get societies that, if they can't live with each other, do separate out in the end, often not peacefully.
It's really difficult, isn't it? Because one gathers that the security services in Nigeria were getting all sorts of reports where these people were going. Some of the girls were being seen, and the central government appears not to have done anything about it. What is one to gather from that? They don't care. They're afraid to leave Lagos and power problems there. Yes, the Americans are going to send military intelligence and help them see things through the jungle and so forth, but they already knew a lot of this. So the problem is much deeper. It's obviously not sectarian because girls of both faiths were taken.
It almost feels like a chain of command thing, doesn't it? You know, that actually, yeah, there may be, you know, the willingness in Lagos to do something, but actually kind of then organising it and getting it done effectively on the ground. There's just too many layers to go through, and you have provincial leaders and people on the ground who don't want to listen to what Lagos is saying.
Paramilitary insurgencies are incredibly difficult to handle in very, very large countries with very, very decentralised systems. Decentralised systems were, for perfectly good reasons, you know, very, very fashionable once upon a time. When you get this kind of violence in them, many layers of administration makes it a lot harder.
Now we're going to cross over to what's happening in Ukraine and Russia. Another military helicopter was downed today by pro-Russian forces in the city of Slavyansk. Well, international pressure on President Vladimir Putin also continued today as it emerged that the White House had pressured key business leaders from companies such as PepsiCo, Goldman Sachs and Morgan Stanley not to attend a high-profile summit in St. Petersburg later this month. George, is this continuing effort to humiliate and isolate Moscow working in any sense?
I can't really see much of a sense in which it is. I understand the dilemma that governments have. If they appear to be continuing business as usual, whether it happens to be the people of government or the people of the private sector, they will be accused by their political opponents of saying, you're not doing anything about this. But on the other hand, it's incredibly difficult to disentangle everybody from the interests which a country and an economy as large as Russia has, first of all. Secondly, everything is kind of planned in. What are they going to do about President Putin coming to the commemoration of the D-Day landings, for example? He's due there. That's early June, I think. And what are they going to do? Disinvite him? Tell him he can't come? You know, argue with him about the Ukraine when he's there? Who knows? Or tell him he's a dreadful guy? These dilemmas are almost impossible to solve. But I really doubt, given the Russian temperament and what we've seen of Putin's behavior so far, and the reception of what he has done in the Ukraine in his own country, I really doubt that small-scale snubs work.
Kathleen, isn't it an interesting dilemma for everybody? Because, you know, although the White House is putting pressure on these companies, you know, if you're running PepsiCo, I understand that these people are saying, actually, we'll send a second tier of kind of leader of our companies. We won't completely pull out, because these people, you know, they employ tens of thousands of people in Russia. They're dependent on the Russian economy for part of their kind of profits. So they're kind of cautious about pulling out. So it's it's a perfect situation, actually, for Putin to kind of make the most of, because he'll be able to say, actually, everybody's here. It's just one or two people didn't come. And if they don't want to come, fine, we don't need them. But this is meant to be, you know, Russia's Davos, and he's not going to let it fail, is he?
Well, it depends on what he wanted to accomplish, other than being on, you know, on television with a whole lot of other economically developed countries, the leaders thereof by him. It would be very difficult for the United States and Europe to call on for economic sanctions if some of the hugest companies in the world appeared to be dismissing the whole concept of sanctions. It's a political ploy. But it's not a stunt. And the thing is that perceptions are very important in this sort of thing. It would have only diverted what credibility Obama has at this point if it could be seen that he couldn't even get American leaders to follow his leadership in trying somehow to isolate Putin, even if it's only symbolically.
But George, as I say, there's so much invested now in Russia. This idea that you can kind of like pull two economies apart, and even, you know, even if you're kind of warring in words at the moment, not on the ground, it just doesn't happen these days. We're such a globalized world that the idea of kind of dismantling all the connections with Russia, you know, we've seen how dependent we are, for example, on their gas. It's great to get, you know, hot under the collar, but in the end, is there much we can really do about this?
Well, I'm not suggesting that people should do nothing here, if you see what I mean. I'm just saying that politicians should be careful about saying that they can do things which actually are extremely hard to deliver. There are lots of economic connections which are very difficult or very expensive to untangle. But you can send some signals. Now, I think whoever is there at Putin's Russian version of Davos, I can more or less guarantee to you that the Russian TV channels will be broadcasting an absolute triumph, absolutely irrespective of who's present or who's not. But I think you can make life more difficult for them, providing you have the business community that is prepared not only to withdraw, but as it were, in some way to stay out. And that's the most difficult thing. It's not really their appearances at conferences that matters. It's what are they going to do over the next couple of years? Because this is not a situation that's going to resolve itself particularly quickly. We could have, at best, you may have a not very violent dismembering of the country we now know as the Ukraine. You might possibly have a Russian withdrawal from the eastern end of the country, although I think that's dubious. My point is, whatever occurs is going to take some time. So the behavior of those businesses, it's not just, are they going to turn up in St. Petersburg? It's what are their investment going to decisions going to be over 2 or 3 years? That's what a government has to try and influence.
Kathleen, when you look at that situation, do you feel it's exactly the same? There's in the end, you know, there are some, a few decisions can be made, but you have to kind of make some painful decisions for your own economy in the end.
Well, yes. I mean, I wouldn't be a German leader right now. I mean, that's the real difficulty, because you may take the so-called wide-ranging view. You can see what's happening in Ukraine. You can see what is starting to happen in Slovakia. You can see what's starting to happen in Moldova. They've put their soldiers on the borders to try to, you know, keep them from people wandering over and destabilizing. The problem with all of these, it's all within Putin's sphere of influence. And that makes it very difficult, because George Bush isn't on the American throne, and so no one is fearful that Barack Obama is going to interfere with soldiers. It's a very difficult situation. Nothing is good in this. There's hardly even, forgive me for sounding so depressing about it, but it's hard to see any light at the end of the tunnel. Just an enduring tunnel.
Well, on that very dark note, we're going to take a short break now. You're listening to Midori House here with me, Andrew Tuck, Kathleen Burke and George Brock. When we return, we'll ask why the US has granted Syria's National Coalition the right to open a diplomatic mission in Washington, D.C. Do stay with us.
On the Foreign Desk this week, we look back 40 years to Portugal's Carnation Revolution.
When my wife told me that there had been a coup in Portugal, my question was in favor or against.
Four decades since dictatorship gave way to democracy, we'll ask what the revolution means to the country today.
I think it's important to realise how dramatically impoverished the dictatorship had left Portugal and how, relatively speaking, the quality of life changed dramatically.
And as Portugal continues to grapple with its economic crisis, how bright is the country's future?
Europe is in a very difficult position, and we should also change not only Portugal, because we can't change only Portugal. We must change Europe too.
That's Revolution Portugal, this week's edition of the Foreign Desk on Monocle 24.
Well, welcome back to Midori House here on Monocle 24. Still with me is Kathleen Burke and George Brock. It was announced a little earlier today the United States has granted permission for the Syrian National Coalition to open a diplomatic mission in Washington, D.C., making it the first government to recognise Syria's political opposition in this way. Kathleen, is this an important step or not? You know, again, we're at a point where nobody kind of really understands how united this opposition is. Many other people are feeling that, The tide of events is almost turning in the way of Bashar al-Assad again. Is it significant or is it just a nicety, do you think?
It's very strange, is what it is. I mean, the Americans aren't giving weapons to the opposition, so it's almost as though this is compensation. The point is, they can't have the embassy. They're not going to get any more support than they've already got. They're denied by all the opposition within Syria. No one pays any attention to the opposition in Washington because they're not fighting. They say they're irrelevant to what's happening. So it's really a bit difficult to see. I mean, it's a cost-free, one might say, way for the Americans to appear to be increasing support without actually doing very much.
George, the status of what's going on at the moment, obviously, it's kind of slightly out of the headlines these days with so much other news going on. We know that on the ground it's still particularly grim, but there seems to be kind of very little movement. It's almost like trench warfare these days, and things do seem to be going more in the way of Bashar al-Assad. For the Syrian National Coalition, does it matter whether they have a diplomatic mission? Do you think it will help their cause? Do you think that they say it will give them additional clout as they go to meet people? But does that seem likely?
Well, I think it probably opens a few doors, but I can't see that it makes much material difference at the end of the day, really. I think it's a kind of concession, because the governing fact here is that these governments, American, British and others, are inhibited from being able to give any material support, even if they want to, by their electorates. That's the governing fact here. And that means that the only things they can give them are other things like little concessions about diplomatic recognition. So I don't honestly think it weighs a great deal in the balance at the end. And I certainly think it isn't going to affect who controls Syria, whether indeed it is decisively one side or the other in 1 year or two or three.
Kathleen.
Yeah, one thing I find very strange about it now is that there's now the tipping point where some of the Western governments, including Britain, I think, are beginning to think, well, maybe Assad's not so bad after all, since what you've got as an alternative are a civil war amongst Islamic jihadists. In other words, if the choice is between your dependable devil and the undependable devil, I suspect more and more the idea is to support, or at least not to argue against Assad, because he at least isn't going to send train fighters back into Hamburg or London or Paris, you know, to carry the war back.
And the funny
to
thing
the
is, there's a little bit of America kind of hedging its bets here, because it's that, as you say, Kathleen, it didn't say to them, okay, take over the embassy. It said, look, we'll leave that kind of shut for now, and we won't do anything about that. This is a kind of a different story running alongside that. You know, obviously they're kind of keen to kind of give the opposition some backing. But there's still an empty embassy there.
I just do not understand the timing of this at all, I must say. There's obviously ideas in Washington about gradations of support, but why did they wait till now?
Well, we're going to move on now, and we're going to head to Iran, where it was revealed today that the authorities there have been building replica US naval vessels, although they say they have, in order to practice destroying them. In fact, a picture emerged today of what looked like a copy of a vast American ship, which was then destroyed. George, what's your reaction to this?
I think this is sort of fantastic movie territory, this, really. I can see a kind of Wes Anderson movie being made about this kind of thing. It is extraordinarily absurd. I would have thought, even in military war game terms, to go to the trouble of building, even if it's not a total replica, something as big as an aircraft, as the largest American aircraft carrier sailing or something like that. I mean, it must have taken months to do. And presumably, it's then pulverized in a matter of seconds. I mean, what does a government that does that, what message is it trying to give? That we will go to absolutely any lengths to make sure that our targeting is perfect? And you don't even need a model of an aircraft carrier in order to... I mean, if it's recognition, it's about silhouettes, it's about... You know, I just don't understand whether this is some vast kind of shadow play or it has some real kind of military or naval purpose that I don't really understand. It is utterly weird.
Kathleen, do you think that with all of these war games, there's an element, you know, whoever's doing it, of kind of, you know, not really of being a practical, useful lesson, but actually kind of like showing off a bit to the world about, you know, we know what you've got and we know what we can do to you?
It's the Potemkin plan, isn't it? Putting up fakes and sailing by it and pretending it's the real thing. The point is, who is it for? Is it for the domestic audience? It must be. It can't possibly be to impress the Americans, who more or less fell about laughing when they saw that it was a fake, you know, Nimitz aircraft carrier. So it must be for domestic consumption. But, you know, they showed how rather good they were when they took over the British ship in the Straits, remember, several years ago. Why they have to pretend to shoot down a plastic aircraft carrier, God knows.
I don't know. Maybe there's a little tug underneath and it's just cardboard on top covering it up. Maybe it's not even a kind of a real ship in that sense. But, George, when you see these manoeuvres, and we saw it, there's a lot of bluffery always, isn't there? When the North Koreans, we saw them kind of like photoshopping additional kind of ships onto the sea and, you know, making things up as they go along. I guess that every side, in a way, is trying to get a bit of bluster with these war games, don't you think?
I think if you're sitting in the United States or Europe, you have a tendency to forget how important war games, also known as exercises, actually are in the rest of the world. They are the equivalent of military chest beating. In America and Europe, war games are virtually invisible and inaudible. They get almost no publicity. They're very discreetly done. Almost nobody sees them. In most of the rest of the world, the whole point is to make them very, very obvious indeed. So you may be sending it. So in the case of the Iranians, they may be sending a domestic audience message, but mostly the audience is the other side.
But Kathleen, I guess, in a more serious level, what we're seeing, what the Russians are doing along the border with Ukraine, we're seeing now, as you mentioned, the kind of the build-up of kind of troops on this other side of the border along Moldova, Slovakia, people being, it's all kind of games as well. It's also showing, it's kind of showing off a bit, isn't it? Kind of making sure that people realise, actually, we're not kind of pussycats. We've got something up our sleeves if you come our way.
Well, we've got NATO, of course, if you want to look that way, which is now increasing the planes and the support and the men and so forth. The thing about the Iran one was that it wasn't an exercise in quite the same way. I mean, showing that you can shoot down a cardboard ship. These other exercises have much more of a threatening character. And you're quite right. I mean, whenever North Korea feels threatened, she shoots a missile over Japan and so forth. They do have I think the point is, these sorts of real-life exercises do have an important military and diplomatic point. What Iran is doing there, the point escapes me.
Well, we're going to have to leave it there for today. Kathleen Burke, Professor of Modern and Contemporary History at University College London, and George Brock, Head of Journalism at City University here in London. Thank you both very much for joining us here today on Midori House.
Vanuit London, dit is Monocle 24.
London으로부터 Monocle 24입니다.
De Londres, essa é a Monocle 24.
位于伦敦, 这是 Monocle 24.
Otlondo, tu vai Monocle 24.
Fra London, dette Monocle 24.
From London, this is Londres.
Hollanda,
London. London으로부터
Hong Kong.
Hong Kong.
Zurich.
London. London.
This is Monocle 24.
Plenty still to come then in the second half of today's Midori House. We'll check in with one of our correspondents around the world. We'll look ahead to this year's International Art Fair of Contemporary Objects and... We'll also look ahead to tonight's first semi-final for this year's Eurovision Song Contest in Copenhagen. But before we get started on any of that, here's James Luckhurst with the world news headlines.
Reports from Nigeria say suspected Boko Haram militants have kidnapped eight more girls in the northeast of the country. The latest kidnapping happened on Sunday night in the village of Warabe in Borno State. The girls taken were between the ages of 12 and 15. Russia's Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov has ruled out holding fresh talks in Geneva to defuse the Ukraine crisis unless pro-Russian opposition groups are involved. Mr. Lavrov added there was no point, as an April accord between the US, EU and Russia had not been implemented. Thailand's Prime Minister has appeared before the Constitutional Court in Bangkok to defend herself against allegations of abuse of power. The complaint was filed by senators who said Mrs. Yingluck Shinawatra's party benefited from improperly transferring her national security chief in 2011. And British politicians have today summoned bosses of the US drug maker Pfizer to explain a $106 billion takeover bid for pharmaceutical firm AstraZeneca. The bid has raised fears over UK jobs, research and intellectual property. Those are the top stories here at Monocle 24.
Thank you very much, James. And James will, of course, be back at the top of the hour with a full bulletin of world news. You're listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24. And it's time now to review one of the corners of the arts world. And today we're talking music. For those looking for the bleeding edge of fashion, there's only one place to head in London, and that's LNCC, a multi-use space in the heart of the Dalston area of the British capital, stocking a selection of the most forward-thinking fashion and accessories. Well, that's what it says here. Amongst the Rick Owens and the Raph Simmons, you'll also find an equally esoteric mix of music, mainly on vinyl, from tropical-tinged disco to new-age minimalism to wigged-out krautrock. That's my favourite. The man behind the music is Johnny Nash, and Monocle's Paul Noble sat down with him earlier to talk music and fashion.
Johnny Nash, welcome along to Monocle 24.
Thanks for having me.
You're a busy guy. You've got lots on. Let's start with LNCC, the store. This is one of those places that people who know about clothes and music know about. And to everyone else, it's completely invisible. So let's talk just a bit of background about the store.
Yeah, sure. So LNCC is basically an online store and a physical store that's based in Dalston, East London. So it's been going since 2011. So like, yeah, just over three years now. And it's really a platform for, sort of showcasing and curating, clothes, books and music with the vision and the perspective of everyone who's involved in it.
And it seems to be a very forward-thinking space, not just in the clothes you stock, but the look of the space as well.
Yeah, I mean, it's definitely a unique environment. I think that's what we always wanted to sort of get across was, sort of showcase what we're into in a retail environment that was slightly different from anything that we'd seen before.
And so what's the thinking behind the music policy of the store? Because there's lots of, fashion brands and fashion spaces that hook up. They say, oh, we want to get a DJ in. But you've done it a bit deeper, haven't you?
Yeah, I mean, I think it just comes basically from the fact that, music is something that a lot of us who've involved in the project have always been into. Myself, John Skelton, the creative director, a lot of the people who work there, we actually met through music rather than fashion. So it runs very deep in throughout the entire team. And I think it's very simply just a case of us selecting and creating the things that we're excited by and the things that we find that we're naturally gravitating towards. So there isn't really any sort of great overarching concept behind it. It is really just us, you know, showcasing what we like and we're excited about, and thinking that if we're excited about it, then hopefully other people will be too.
All right, so let's get into it. Let's have your first track. What have you brought for us today?
Okay, so I brought something that was actually an artist who we released on our own record label, LNCC Recordings. So this is a new project by George Thompson, who's also known as Black Merlin. And this is coming out on ESP Institute label in a few months, I think. It's a collaboration with a Dusseldorf-based producer called Gordon Pohl. The artist's name is Keramika, and this is a track called Ton One.
Definitely a treat in the headphones. So kind of on the krauty heavy end of things.
Definitely. I mean, Gordon, one half of that project, he's from Dusseldorf, and I think a lot of people are kind of referencing kraut rock music. I think that what those guys in Dusseldorf are doing, you know, bands like Kreidler, Music Cargo, Stable Elite, I think they really are the real deal, and I think this whole LP is really, really a great listen all the way through.
Great. So what have you got next for us?
So next up is forthcoming on LNCC Recordings. This is a Japanese artist called Xpei, who's based in Osaka. He's kind of like an experimental guitar player, uses a lot of loops effects, and he's very much part of that sort of experimental scene in Osaka. So this is a track called Episode, and it should be coming out in a few months on LNCC Recordings.
Spacey stuff.
Yeah, so that's coming out with a couple of remixes, one from Music Cargo and one from Lord of the Isles, as well as the original.
And so just tell us, where does Japan feature in your musical map?
It's somewhere that I used to live, actually. I lived there for 4 years. So I was kind of involved with the music scene in Tokyo during that time, about 10 years ago. And I've kind of kept on a lot of the connections with those guys out there. I mean, I record myself still on and off for Kurel Recordings, also for Cosmes. They've got a little label called Snaker, so I've done an album for those guys. So I still kind of keep up my own personal music projects related to Japan a lot. Yeah, I think there's a lot of interesting artists and producers, and a lot of amazing DJs as well. So, you know, it's quite natural that in LNCC, you know, we've kind of kept those connections on and worked with those people.
Yeah, and there's certainly a similar sort of very broad-minded and eclectic approach.
Yeah, definitely.
To what you're doing.
Definitely.
There as well. And so if we were to come into LNCC, you've got equipment there as well to buy and to listen to music on.
Yep, that is correct. I mean, at the moment, the store is undergoing refurbishment, but we do have a dedicated area in there for listening to music and for trying out equipment. You know, we sell, you know, sort of high-end headphones from the likes of brands like Grado and Nagaoka, cartridges, stylus, all those kind of things. So, yeah, we really, you know, wanted to... You know, to pay attention and to pay focus to not just the records themselves, but also the equipment for listening to them that goes along with, you know, enjoying vinyl.
Absolutely. Well, that's definitely a Monocle territory. We're going to have to end on one tune. Do you want to pick one out of your final tracks for us to play us out?
Yeah, I think I'd like to pick a release that we released on LNCC Recordings last year, which was an excellent project we did with Phil Manzanera of Roxy Music. We got access to his master tapes, and we picked a bunch of remixes who we thought would be, you know, sympathetic to what was this amazing archive of material. My favorite out of the 7 remixes we did was this one, a remix of Listen Now by Velvet Seasons and The Heart of Gold.
Who are Velvet Seasons?
So that is Joel Martin from Quiet Village and Jerry Rooney.
Two guys with a long disco charge sheet between them down the years.
Definitely.
Where would we find you DJing around London and the world?
So I'm doing a sort of monthly thing at London Fields at the moment, the sort of bar strip pub there. Aside from that, I'm sometimes playing in Ace Hotel on Mondays. And yeah, I'll be doing sort of more live gigs with my Land of Light project later on this year.
Sounds good. Johnny Nash, thanks very much.
And that was Listen Now by Phil Manzanera, remixed by Velvet Seasons. And Paul Noble was talking to Johnny Nash from LNCC. You're listening to Midori House, live on Monocle 24 with me, Andrew Tuck. We're going to check in with one of our correspondents around the world, who happens to be in Paris, right after this short break. Stay with us.
The beret is not just a French cliché. It's a cherished piece of heritage at risk of extinction. Monocle Films pays a visit to the last berry maker in France and meets an Irishman trying to revive this quintessentially French piece of headwear.
L'Olaire has now earned the label of Living Heritage Company, Entreprise de Patrimoine Vivant, a reward from the French government to salute a firm's excellence in keeping alive a unique tradition. As the last manufacturer of a product so deeply ingrained in French DNA, L'Olaire and its berets are worth fighting for.
Vive le Béret, premiering on Monocle.com.
And welcome back to Midori House, live here on Monocle 24. Time now to check in with one of our correspondents around the world. Today, we head to France and our Paris correspondent, Tom Burgess Watson. He joins me now on the line. Tom, thank you for joining us. We want to start, first of all, with the second anniversary of President Hollande being in power. Is there much to celebrate?
I don't think there's a great sense of a carnival on the streets of France today. 2 years ago, François Hollande came to office with all sorts of promises and bringing with him lots of hope that he was going to turn the page. It was just a fairly dark period in France's economic history 2 years ago, and people were hoping that he would be able to turn things around, reduce unemployment, and perhaps do what he promised to do, which was to steer clear of austerity. But here we are, 2 years later, and only one in five voters trust President Hollande. He's the most unpopular president in modern history. And he's blaming his predecessor now for all the country's financial woes. He says, in fact, he saved France because it would have gone bankrupt were it not for him. But the situation is that there are 3 million people unemployed. You know, he said in his address when he spoke to the people of France today, he gave an exclusive interview to a radio station on the occasion of his second anniversary, saying, "I hear the anger, I'm not deaf, we must act faster." Well, he's just appointed a new prime minister after the abysmal performance of his party in the municipal elections in March. So perhaps this new prime minister, Manuel Valls, who's a tough-talking man, he's going to help turn things around. But I don't know if you remember, 2 years ago, his presidency got off to a fairly inauspicious start. He was traveling down the Champs-Élysées in an open-top car in the pouring rain. He was soaked. And then he got on an aeroplane to go and see Angela Merkel in Germany, and the plane was struck by lightning. So perhaps not the best start for his presidency.
And a little bit of financial news, just explain this in nice friendly terms for our listeners. So France isn't in Brussels good books either.
No, it isn't, because the European Commission has just issued a series of forecasts on Monday. They're picturing the scenario whereby France won't meet its budgetary targets either this year or in 2015. Now, of course, I was just mentioning their public spending, and this is all part of the slowness of the government to implement the cuts that should have been implemented back in 2012 when the party came to power. The deficit, of course, shouldn't be higher than 3% of GDP. That's the rule of the European Union, and France is a major power in the European Union. It's the second largest Eurozone economy. So overshooting those targets, that's a terrible example. And I think people in Berlin, as well as Brussels, are pretty fed up. But the finance minister here in France, Michel Sapin, he says that those forecasts are wrong. And in fact, they don't take into account the latest cost-saving initiative. So France being slightly defensive about that criticism from Brussels.
But if President Hollande wants to escape the country, he can at last, because it seems that the Air France is not going to go on strike after all.
After all, it isn't. We were expecting absolute chaos because the pilots' union of Air France KLM said that from the 3rd to the 30th of May, that's a huge long time, almost 1 month, they were going to take strike action beginning on Friday. And on the eve of that strike, they said they weren't going to go ahead with it after all. That's because Air France unions wanted the airline to promise that it wouldn't bring in replacement pilots from other countries if ever there was industrial action. And they did that because EasyJet and various other airlines as well recruit replacement pilots from other countries to protect passengers in the event of industrial action. But Air France has just promised its unions that it won't do that, having resisted to give that promise right up until the day before that strike was due to go ahead. So what it means is that next time there's an Air France strike, the airline will have fewer options. But at least what they've done is saved themselves a hugely expensive and damaging 3-week-long period of disruption.
And finally, another little story from Belgium. Well, kind of Belgium come France. This is a pop singer who's made it big in France. He's actually Belgian, but he's now about to take the US by storm. Tell us about him.
Yes, his name is Stromae, which is an anagram of maestro, which is a kind of, it's quite trendy in France to inverse words, and it has been for quite some time. But this singer is just going from strength to strength. Stromae is Rwandan and Flemish by origin. He sings in French, and he's been named by the major poll here in France, the Energie Music Awards of 2014, as the Artiste Masculin Français de l'année, the Francophone Artist of the Year. President Obama apparently has his new album. Kanye West is a big fan, and he's about to go to the United States, and he's on the front cover of the Time Out New York edition this week. And the caption reads, "Who the hell is Stromae?" And then it goes on to tell you he is the most famous star you've never heard of. Well, he's going to perform in New York on the 20th of June. There was a survey just a couple of days ago in Le Parisien newspaper in which 87% of French adults said they liked this guy and had a positive impression of him. He's only 30 years old, and apparently that's a record for anyone in terms of the degree to which they're liked by the French public. So perhaps the crowning glory for him is that a museum here in Paris called the Musée Grévin, which is a bit like Madame Tussauds in London, is going to unveil a statue of him later on this year. So everything going right for that French-speaking singer, although he is from Belgium.
Thank you very much, Tom. That was, of course, Tom Burgess-Watson, our Paris correspondent. And you're listening to Midori House. And welcome back to Midori House with me, Andrew Tuck. Well, the world's collectors of contemporary crafts will descend on London later this week for the annual Collect Art Fair, where some of the designers, artists and craftsmen and women of contemporary objects will exhibit their wares. And I'm delighted to say that Daniela Wells, the show director of Collect 2014, joins me in the studio now. Daniela, explain to people exactly what we mean by contemporary objects. What falls into that category for you?
Yes, well, contemporary objects, essentially, I guess what we're talking about is works of art. So that's jewellery, ceramics, glass, textiles and wood and metal.
And paper. Sorry, I've ruffled your paper there.
We do actually have a fantastic paper installation by Angela Fung upstairs in the on the second floor as well. So, yeah, it's decorative arts, applied arts, but we've been deliberately ambiguous about objects.
OK, and we know that craft seems to be meant, even if you read Monocle, in fact, you'll see the word craft, I think, on almost every page these days. Craft has become something actually quite celebrated at the moment. I think, you know, post the economic crash, we went back to the idea of making stuff and the belief in making things and the value of tradition and using it in a more contemporary way. Do you feel there's been an upsurge of interest in what you're doing?
Very much. I mean, contemporary craft, you say craft can span a huge number of things. There's crafted beers, there's crafted this, there's crafted all manner of different paths of life at the moment. But I think people are really looking at how objects are made, what they're made from, what the story is behind them. And certainly, I mean, the fair collector is now going into its 11th year. It's very, very popular and people are really looking and learning from people working today.
Now, Daniela, one of the key words in there is collect.
it's not just buy, it's not just a kind of a shopping spree you're suggesting to people. The idea that people start building collections, I guess. And is that something else that is, you know, there's a keenness to do and understanding? I think that lots of people in the past may have been able to afford like one painting in their lifetime. And now because of editions and things, you see people actually with a modest amount of money being able to build up tiny collections of their own of editions and things. With craft, sometimes it feels a little bit more affordable as an entry point into the collecting world. Again, are you trying to encourage people to become collectors?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, there are a number of people that would be termed a contemporary craft collector, but they're kind of quite a small number of people. We have all manner of different of people purchasing from the fair. People are actually antiques collectors. They're interested in contemporary art. A number of different types of people, but. I think it has made a big difference over the last decade with the purchases by museums from the fair. So the V&A, for example, is where we launched the fair, and a number of curators go around the fair to select and purchase for public collections. So someone that's interested will see a work in a public collection now and really realise its value. And as you say, you know, are people amassing a collection of contemporary craft? Yes, certainly, whether they call themselves a collector or not, people are buying objects for their home and they're really thinking about how they display them in their home.
So just we should let people know, it begins this Friday, doesn't it, at the Saatchi
yes.
Gallery?
Yeah, absolutely. We take over all three floors of the Saatchi Gallery. So there's 37 galleries in by way of exhibitors for us. And they're from all across the world as well. So I'm looking forward to seeing them during the setup tomorrow. And there's 13 different countries represented overall. So they're on the ground of first floor in the Saatchi Gallery. And then on the top floor, we've got the project space. And that's seven installations, people that are not necessarily represented by galleries, but working on special projects and representing their own work. And we also have an exhibition upstairs on the second floor as well.
So I was looking at your site. There's everything on there from jewellery to ceramics, all sorts of things. What other kind of things can we expect to see?
There is a real variety of scale. There's a fantastic selection of what we term art jewellery. The jewellers that we have at Collect are not necessarily interested in diamonds and sort of the value of stones, but are about jewellery as a piece of sculpture. And there's really exquisite works, and you really have to go and look. There's an awful lot to see. We have a lot of very large scale ceramics, particularly this year. Ceramics is my passion. That's what I studied originally. And there's works by Julian Stair, both on the stands at the stand at Collect and the first floor, but then also in an exhibition upstairs.
And just tell me, are all the pieces new pieces, or does Collect kind of take in stuff that's been done over the last 20, 30 years as well?
Yes, so there's, we say about 90% of what's represented by the dealers on their stands should be contemporary, and that means literally made in the last few years. So there are a few historical pieces, and that's quite important in terms of the context of the fair and for people to understand a little bit of the history. But it's really important for us that this is contemporary. So actually, a lot of the dealers have been doing the fair since the first year back at the V&A, and we have a commitment with them to bring 15% of new artists as well. So they'll revisit a lot of very well-known names in our sector, but also we'll be introducing new people, and that's very important. So I mean, I've been going to the fair and working on the fair for several years, and I'll still see very, very new work.
Well, brilliant. Thank you so much for coming to see us. That was Daniela Wells, the show director of Collect 2014. And as she mentioned, it begins on Friday here in London at the Saatchi Gallery. I'd recommend that you go along. Thank you very much for joining us here on Monocle 24. Well, you know what's coming up very soon? It's the Eurovision Song Contest. And here at Monocle 24, we have a man who knows more about that subject than anybody else. His name is Fernando Augusto Pacheco, and here's his little package about what to expect.
You're all alone. Well, well, well. Time flies and it's time for Eurovision again. Last year I was in Malmo to cover my first Eurovision, and what an experience it was. From Romanian vampires to Irish muscle Marys. It was spectacular. But worry not, Eurovision this year does not disappoint. We have Russian twins, a bearded Austrian drag queen, and so on. For those who don't know, before the grand final on Saturday, there will be two semi-finals, one today and the other one on Thursday, which will define which countries will be on the final. Oh, and five countries do not need to worry about that, as they are automatically classified: the UK, Spain, France and Italy, and the host country, which this year is Denmark. They support the event financially, that's why, not because of some sort of great musical talent. Here's a little guide for today's semi-final. Most importantly, the bookies' favorite is performing tonight, Aaron MP3 from Armenia. His song, Not Alone, is hotly tipped to win the contest this year. You'll be a first for Armenia. The song is quite good, a powerful ballad that ends with some dubstep beats. You're not another hot favorite will perform tonight. The Swedes, always the Swedes. We have Sanna Nielsen with Undo. Keeping on trend is a ballad. This year, for those looking for a more up-tempo beat, you have to look harder. Undo could bring the contest to Sweden again next year. And Eurovision is not all about feathery costumes. It is also political. Think Ukraine or Russia. There's been some controversy on how the Crimean vote will be counted, possibly as Ukrainian, as they're still on the Ukrainian mobile network. It'll be interesting to see if both countries will vote for each other. Both Ukraine and Russia are performing today. Two good entries. Ukraine always do very well with their divas. This year, we have Maria Yarinchuk with TikTok. Russia goes for a more sweet affair, and they go with twins, the Tomachevy sisters with Shine. So 90s. And never underestimate the Hungarians. They have a strong ballad this year, and could be the dark horses of the competition. This is Andras Kalei Saunders with Running. She keeps on running, running, running. This crazy life, she keeps on running, 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 never sees the light. Enjoy the first semi-final and may the best win. For Monaco, I'm Fernando Augusto Pacheco.
And if you want to hear more from Fernando, you can, because every day he's going to be on the Atlantic shift from 1500 hours London time, reporting on events from Copenhagen. And that's all we have time for on today's Midori House. My thanks in particular to our special guests, Kathleen Burke and George Brock. Today's show was produced by Thomas Lewis, research by Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Sarah Fournier. And our studio manager, well, that was Bill Luthi. Next, after the headlines, is Section D. Then at 2200 hours is the Monocle Daily. This show will be back at the same time tomorrow, 1800 hours London time. But for this edition of Midori House, it's just time to say goodbye and thank you very much for listening.
Rolex is responsible for several landmark innovations in watchmaking, including the Oyster, the first waterproof wristwatch and the perpetual rotor self-winding mechanism. Crafted from the finest raw materials and assembled with scrupulous attention to detail, Oyster Perpetual watches benefit from Rolex's cutting-edge technology and extensive expertise. Epitomizing the values that have made the brand world famous, Oyster Perpetual watches symbolize a way of life, a benchmark for style.